Hello and welcome to this special sponsored edition of the Spectator podcast. I'm Kate Andrews. While the COVID pandemic rages on, eyes are starting to turn to our economic recovery. With the most severe economic contraction of any major country, coupled with a looming unemployment crisis, innovative and bold ideas are needed now more than ever to get the economy back on track. With a forthcoming defense review, thought to be the biggest since World War II, now is the time to look at how defense, engineering, and manufacturing sectors can help rebuild the post-COVID economy. Joining me to discuss this today are Tobias Elwood, Conservative MP and Chair of the Defense Select Committee, Tony Danker, Head of Be the Business and incoming Director General of the CBI, and Charles Woodburn, CEO of BAE Systems. And thanks to BAE for kindly sponsoring this podcast. Charles, I'll come to you first. Threats of security were changing long before this crisis, with more emphasis on cybersecurity. What impact, if at all, has the pandemic had on the way we think about security?
I mean, the pandemic has forced all of us to think, you know, very carefully at, you know, how the UK can be exposed. And cyber, as you know, is an area that we've been looking at for quite some time. But, you know, we've seen cyber activity in both the government space, but also in the civilian space, cyber activity or malicious cyber activity pick up over the course of the pandemic. You know, I think that the threats or bad actors will always look for ways to expose. And when, you know, normal means of travel are hindered, they will use alternative routes. And cyber has been an area that they've been, I think, quite aggressive through this pandemic environment. And not just in the UK, we've seen it in the other Five Eyes nations around the world, this spike up in cyber activity. It's an area that in BAE we've been investing in capability for quite some time, both on the defence side, but also in the civilian side, financial crime, anti-money laundering activities, you know, dealing with large banks. And it's a skill set that you learn in the defence side that actually lends itself quite well to certain areas of civil, large data analytics, you know, looking at large data sets and looking for anomalous activities or suspicious activities across huge, diverse sets of data. That's a common skill set that we use in many parts of our business.
Tobias, has COVID-19 made us rethink our defence strategy?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, from where I sit, the world was already becoming quite a dangerous place. We're, I think, being more siloed, where countries are retreating from global exposure because of COVID-19. And there's an absence of what actually the West stands for, what we believe in, what we're willing to defend. And countries with very different agendas, non-state actors and non-state actors, are fully taking advantage of that. You'd think the superpowers would come together collectively to try and solve some of the challenges of COVID-19. This is, you know, the global pandemic in this sense. And we're actually seeing us ratchet or slide towards potentially another Cold War. Not in the way that we saw the last one, which was a build-up of weapon systems east side of an Iron Curtain, but more into political competition. And this is where cyber and space actually comes into it, because there are no rules written about how you conduct yourselves in space. We've got some international organizations that desperately need updating. So we're entering a very different or dangerous era now, I think, provoked further by the problems of COVID-19.
Tony, Charles and Tobias have made clear that the defense sector thinks that COVID-19 has radically changed the game. I suppose this compares well to what many businesses across the board have experienced during this crisis.
Yeah, I mean, it's been really an amazing period for British business, almost beneath the surface of what we hear about on a daily basis in the news. There's been an unprecedented amount of efficiency drive, innovation drive, technology adoption drive. I mean, the kind of things that for the last 12 years worried about UK productivity, we've been really worried the British economy and British businesses weren't embarking upon. And they have been embarking upon it because they've had to. Now, don't get me wrong, it doesn't mean that our productivity stats are going to look great. Output is still low, demand is lower than cost. And so you've got a troubled industry sector, but you've got some underlying behaviours in response to the crisis that I think give us a clue to how we do this thing that, you know, we now call a cliche, is a bit of a cliche where we talk about Britain building back better. But I think there are conditions for Britain building back better. Charles will know better than me whether that's true in the defence sector. But I think COVID has been an external shock to the way we do business. And I think if we're smart, we'll think about how to use the next 6 months to truly build back better.
Charles, what is the role of the UK defence equipment industry in preparing us for future demands? And what is it primarily for? Are we looking to equip our own armed forces? Or as an industry, does it want to be a strong export arm to the rest of the world?
Well, it's a very good question. And the truth is, it's a combination of all of the above. I mean, obviously, defence and security of the UK is a primary driver. But the pandemic and the economic challenges we now find ourselves in as a country, I think, has thrown into sharp relief the need for economic prosperity. And I think the defence sector has an awful lot that they can bring in that regard. You know, we employ about 34,000 people across the UK, 21,000 in the north of England. These are highly skilled jobs. And for our 34,000, there's a total of 124,000 when you include people in our supply chain. So that's a lot of highly skilled jobs right across the UK. And when the UK economy is suffering as it is, and indeed, you know, many global economies are on the back of the COVID pandemic, we believe that investment in defence can really help in the recovery of the UK in the post-COVID world. And then there's the Global Britain agenda. You know, as the UK in a post-Brexit world looks to strengthen relationships with other countries like Australia or Canada, where we already have strong trading relationships with, through, for example, the Frigate programme. I mean, these are programmes that have huge benefit to the UK. I mean, a programme such as that, you know, everything below the waterline in that frigate is common, and a huge number of UK suppliers benefit when, you know, a frigate such as that gets sold around the world. So, as I said, I like to think that UK defence sector has a key role to play in the economic recovery in a post-COVID world.
We'll dig into your points about skill sets and funding later on in the podcast, but to stick with this point, Tobias, should the sector be seen principally for supplying the UK with defence capability, or do politicians see it as an industry in its own right?
I don't think politicians actually understand it. I was looking at some of the stats. Back in Churchill's time, over half of the cabinet had military experience. The same with Thatcher as well. Today, we have one person who served in the regular forces. That's the defence secretary. And sadly, we keep reading that he might be booted out for whatever reason. And that does not bode well. It means that we don't really get what our armed forces can actually do. That was actually reflected going back to COVID-19. Their contribution to tackling this virus. Yes, they built the Nightingales. They did some great transport logistics things. But the one department that actually plans for emergencies, that is trained in crisis response, that have the strategic thinkers, is the MOD, but they're kept out of the room in planning our entire country approach as to how we tackle this. So going in answering your question, we need to better understand how our defence can actually help us from the prosperity perspective. We're leaving the EU. We're going to be looking for great new trading opportunities in other countries. An easy way to do that is to actually develop security defence strengths, training and so forth, utilisation of Sandhurst and Shrivenham, upstream engagement with these countries, develop a relationship, bring in a bit of governance work from DFID, and then that's a pincer movement to develop further trade, often in the areas of defence and aerospace. And I don't think that's actually particularly understood in the bowels of Whitehall.
So perhaps you'd like to see more recruitment of candidates with a military background?
Well, there's either that or you actually better understand what the defence offers to our prosperity. Let's also not forget that our economic prosperity or economic security is absolutely tied to international security. I touched on the fact that the world is getting more dangerous. Shipping lanes and so forth are being challenged all the time, including underwater international communications cables. We need to be able to patrol more. We need to advance our maritime fleet. If we want to trade with new opportunities around the world, we have to protect those trading routes. And at the moment, the scale of our Navy at the moment isn't going to be able to do that.
Tony?
I think one of the most interesting, that there are a couple of assets I think the defence sector brings really to the UK's overall competitiveness. And one is extremely relevant to the government's agenda, and that is about levelling up. You know, I've had the privilege of looking across the whole economy, every sector, big business, small business, in every part of the country. And one of the things that really stands out about the defence sector is that when you have those prime companies at the defense sector at the top of supply chains, wherever they're based regionally, they really become institutions at the heart of clusters, at the heart of regional growth. That's a BAE story, but it's also the story for other companies in the defense sector. And so I think actually the defense sector is pretty interesting from a leveling up point of view, because usually there are companies outside the Southeast, they're large employers, but they're also at the heart of local clusters of innovation, of supply chain development, of leadership and management, education with local universities and so on. So I think the defense sector is very interesting from that point of view. And I think secondly, you know, the defense sector is usually at the heart of manufacturing excellence. BAE, Rolls-Royce, GSK, Siemens, those have been companies who in our work at Be The Business, they have really led the manufacturing sector in initiatives such as Made Smarter or in supply chain development, technology adoption, leadership and management capability, lean operations capability. So I think two of the things not often discussed about the defense sector are A, the role it plays in leveling up, and B, the leadership role it plays within the manufacturing sector overall.
Tony, that's an interesting point, because defense capability doesn't mean what it used to mean. We're not just talking about defense, we're talking about a myriad of things, engineering, manufacturing, as you said. When we talk about investment, should we be talking about those sectors just as much as we talk about defense?
Yeah, I think we know that the multiplier effect of manufacturing across the whole economy is great. We know that within manufacturing, a lot of great manufacturing businesses are moving into servitization. They're becoming services businesses as well. I think investment in advanced manufacturing has proven to be highly generative for the UK economy. And again, I come back to this regional economy point, which, of course, is right at the heart of the government's economic strategy. They are usually hugely important anchoring institutions in local economic development.
I think just building on Tony's point that the multiplier effect, I mean, that's effectively what gives you a sort of an extra multiplier effect, is the export, you know, angle of programs, so that funds spent in the UK to develop a program, you know, when that then gets exported, obviously you get this multiplier effect back in the UK. And we've got some great examples over the history. The Hawk, for example, the advanced jet trainer, that was an initial investment of £800 million by the government. And over the life of that, that generated over £16 billion for the UK economy. The Typhoon, not to quite the same extent, but the UK invested £12 billion and has got twice that back already and counting over the life of a programme such as that. So when you look at things like Tempest or the Type 26, you know, when we've got plenty of good evidence to show that when investments are made and then exported on the world stage, you get this multiplier effect, which really adds to even the multiplier effect that Tony was referring to. And I think there's few areas of government spending which can be seen almost as the R&D investment, that you spend a pound up front and you get £5 back over the life of a programme. And that is very much, I think, one of the key drivers between linking defence spending into long-term national prosperity.
Tobias?
I think if you want to sell things abroad, then you have to sell things that people want. And therefore, we need to introduce greater versatility, greater flexibility into our equipment. The Type 26 frigate was mentioned. This is a great bit of kit, but it's also very, very expensive. And we need to have a greater modular system, I think, built in, so people can actually pick and choose. A bit like, you know, purchasing a phone. I've got one in my hand now. If we compared all our phones, we'd have different apps on there, but we all have the same phone often. And we need to be better, I think, at creating things which have versatility built in it. Our aircraft carriers, for another example, are amazing bits of kit, but they're actually designed for a high-end, low-probability, high-risk event of us taking on, let's say, the Chinese or the Russians using fifth-generation kit. We need to introduce greater versatility and flexibility so that can actually be used 95% of the time when we're not taking on these high-end threats. And the second point I made, and I remember being in Kuwait at the time, trying to sell the Warrior to the Kuwaitis. And it wasn't actually the Warrior, it was the turret on top of it. I couldn't choose a winner because there were two British companies vying for the job. So I then said to the Kuwaitis, you choose, we've got two great companies here. The French came in with Thales and said, this is our winner. The government backed the company, and guess who got the deal? It was the French, not us, because the Kuwaitis were convinced that because the French government was behind it, it must be worth something. And that, I think, we need to change our approach to this.
Tony, there's a lot of talk of new skill sets that will be needed in a post-COVID economy. It would hardly be surprising if engineering and manufacturing were included in this. But to what extent can government predict or prepare for this reskilling?
Well, I think government already is taking a point of view about industries of the future, jobs of the future, skills of the future versus those of the past. And you can tell in the Chancellor's recent statement a desire to focus, to future-proof the spending that we make today. And a lot of people discuss the retraining agenda. By the way, retraining has been discussed for decades in most advanced economies around the world. And usually the solutions are not commensurate with the size of the problem. I think what COVID-19 has done, obviously unintentionally and tragically, is it's provided us with a rare window of opportunity to remake our economy and make it future-proof. And therefore, I am hopeful that this retraining agenda, which is in essence to equip our workforce for industries and jobs of the future rather than those of the past, that that takes hold. Because, you know, I think we'll remember 2020 as a period of unbelievably bold leadership, unbelievable levels of proactivity compared to any historic parallel since the war. And I think we want to use that time wisely. So I'd be incredibly enthusiastic about very, very bold retraining proposals. You know, it's the old adage, never waste a crisis. And I think this is a time where I think the country and employees across the country are up for and engaged with bold and radical solutions to future-proofing our economy or future-proofing their own careers. So let's use the time wisely.
Tobias, we know that we have a looming unemployment crisis on our hands. The government has already started to try to couple its green energy agenda with getting people back into work. Could we see the government use areas like defense, engineering, and manufacturing to try to boost jobs as well?
Yes, I think there's a huge opportunity there. I mean, firstly, I think credit to the Chancellor in doing an incredible economic intervention compared with other countries where we try to salvage those skill sets, both in large businesses but in SMEs. There's no doubt about it that all countries are going to suffer from COVID-19. But the aerospace piece is the exciting area. And I think we just remind ourselves how innovative Britain has been. I mean, this is where the TV was invented, you know, the internet, the telephone, the computer, the web. The tank itself came about because there was a requirement for it, as indeed the bouncing bomb. You know, we have it in us to actually create something and do something. We've got exciting areas of graphene to be explored, quantum computing. You know, we started this conversation about cyber and space. Our reliance, which is actually what COVID-19 has thrust us towards. You know, even if my mother, you know, in her dotage can actually harness a Zoom conversation, this shows where culturally we're then all going. So we need to be on the cusp of this. We need to absolutely be able to recognize this. And I think that's exactly where this government wants to go.
Charles, what's the private sector's role in preparing the workforce for future demands? In what areas do you think we need more skilled workers? And what would, say, BAE or any major company do to aid this process?
Well, we've been doubling down through these difficult times with the commitment to hiring the 800 apprentices. We've continued graduate recruiting. Fortunately for us, our big programs have been supported by governments. Obviously, we've got the integrated review here in the UK, but you know, we are taking a long-term view here. We recognise that a crisis such as this is incredibly difficult for young people in particular, people coming into the workforce. And we, you know, whilst we've been getting support, you know, from governments in terms of maintaining funding for those key programmes, we haven't used the furlough scheme here in the UK. Our objective has been to get people, you know, back to work as quickly as possible, either working from home where they can and repivoting to a working from home environment, or in the big manufacturing facilities, getting people back into the workplace. And we temporarily had to stand down the apprentices simply because they were not, in a sense, essential. But over the course of the summer, we've now got all of our apprentices back. And you see the life return of the young people coming back into the big manufacturing centres and now being able to recruit and get some fresh blood in. the skills are changing. The Industry 4.0, the factory of the future that we're developing for Tempest. I mean, that really, there's as much investment going on in a program such as that, where we've currently got about 1,000 people between us and our partners working on that program. There's as much investment going on in sort of the high-end engineering, the aerodynamics that you'd imagine, as on what we would describe the factory of the future. Can we demonstrate to this government that we can build a sixth generation fighter capability at half the time and half the cost? And that's a very, very bold thing to do. And we've got a lot of, you know, young people now working on a bunch of techniques such as additive layer, growing large scale metal components, but on a much greater scale than has been done anywhere else in the world. I mean, these are all investments that we're making. And in fact, up in Wharton today, you can go up there and see some of these significant investments that we're making. And it's all to be able to demonstrate to the government that we can take cost and time out of developing an incredibly advanced capability.
Tony, to what extent has the crisis sped up our use of technology and automation? And particularly, how does that relate to our defense strategies?
I think, again, when we look back on this period, one of the most dramatic shifts in UK business behavior has been technology adoption. We've recently surveyed, in particular, the SME and micro sector. You know, large companies have been active users of technology for a long time now. And we detected in the first 3 months of the crisis almost four times the rate of, for example, e-commerce adoption on 2019. And yes, everyone's been forced into, you know, using Zoom and using Teams and using WebEx, etc. for video conferencing. But I think SME Britain has recognized the importance of technology, not just for growth, but for resilience. I mean, you know, in very intuitive terms, people have found themselves working from home and they've realized that you need more than Zoom to work from home. You need to have cloud-based HR and finance systems. You need to have CRM systems to manage your customer relationships. You can't rely on the Rolodex in the office. So I really think what's happened is utterly dramatic when it comes to technology adoption. We have to lock that in. One of the things we're arguing with the Chancellor is that if we really want to think about building back better and what's happened to British business in the last 6 months, locking in that technology adoption, finding ways to build tech capability on the back of the huge confidence surge and usage surge of businesses across the country in using technology, that's a really big opportunity. Charles will probably be better placed to think about what that means in the defence sector. The only thing I can point to is you may be familiar with Made Smarter. It's a program BAE and others have been involved in. It's trying to drive the adoption of Industry 4.0 technologies across defense and other manufacturing sectors. And one of the things that's been revealed in the last 6 months is that actually a lot of SME Britain lack the basic digital capabilities to adopt advanced and deep tech. They need to build almost their digital health and maturity in order to be truly at the frontier edge that I think our large defense companies need them to be when it comes to adoption of future technologies. So I think we need to get all of Britain tech smart, and we'll never have an opportunity quite like this one, given the levels of confidence and adoption in technology that we've seen in the last 6 months.
But just to build on that, if I may, for a moment, Tony, I think that the mentoring program that Be The Business has organized is very helpful for that. I know we've got, I think, 100 of our managers mentoring SMEs across, you know, a range of different sectors. And there, I think, Be The Business, is, in terms of just standing that up and making sure that the learnings from one company are passed to another, has been very helpful.
Tobias, Tony speaks about confidence to continue to invest and to embrace these technological advancements. Do you think the way the government has dealt with the pandemic so far does give you confidence and business confidence that the government's in a position to properly level up?
That's a really, really good question. We're 6 months on and we're now going through a second wave. I made the point in the chamber that I believe that the decision making that we've seen at the very, very top, you know, we could do better. We have a peacetime construct, which is well tested, but it's risk averse. We've not shifted in dealing with this COVID-19 crisis into a war footing. So you still have ministers making phone calls, chasing PPE, trying to get testing kits and so on. That isn't the job of the minister. I go back to the armed forces. They're actually well placed to actually do this. So the operational delivery of whatever decisions you make there's been a disjoint between the two itself. When it comes to planning for post-COVID-19, I think we're in a much, much better place. We've touched on the importance. The Prime Minister's speech today is all about making up and compensating for the hit that a generation of students have been affected by because their studies have been so impacted and troubled because of COVID-19, with more problems now in universities, absolutely, as we see. If we're to catch up on that, then we need to invigorate the programme to get those pupils and indeed the university students back up to par, but also making sure that industries are able to receive those people and do their piece as well. Apprenticeships was mentioned. That's a great way to take people on and involve them. But I go back to the point that Britain is in a good place to be able to do this. Space is an area, most people don't know that most satellites, which are, you know, smaller than a fridge, are probably made in the UK or UK has some involvement in that. That's a great place to actually be. We're now going to be, you know, developing a launch capability from the UK as well. You know, there is much of us to be proud of as to where we can actually go. But of course, at the moment, we just have this fog of COVID-19 to get through, first of all.
Tony, the defence review was delayed due to the pandemic, understandably so. It is now charging ahead with findings expected to be published before the end of the year. There are increasing calls for more manufacturing in Britain's backyard in the name of self-sufficiency. But it's a fine line between making procurement choices in the name of national security and in the name of protectionism. Where do you think the line should be drawn?
Look, I think the fundamental question for the next 5 years is how are we going to compete successfully in the world when we leave the European Union? It's a real question and challenge, but it's also a huge opportunity. And so I think from talking to SME Britain in particular, who are in the supply chains of defence companies or large manufacturing supply chains across the world, there's a few things that are very clear, and I'm sure Charles would endorse this. Number one, British-based defence or manufacturing companies will want to, in the defence sector it's for security reasons, but they will want to build British supply chains if they can. Those are more resilient, they're good for the country, they're good for logistics, but only to the point that it makes sense. This is an internationally traded sector, and therefore most of our largest and best manufacturing companies have global supply chains. So what does all this mean? I think what it means is that we are going to have to invest in the development of supply chain competitiveness in this country. We're just going to have to do that if we want to build that self-sufficiency. We need to be as competitive as the rest of the world. By the way, we need to be as competitive as the rest of the world to flourish post-Brexit. And we need to be as competitive in the rest of the world if we are going to convince companies like Charles and others in defence and more broadly in the manufacturing sector that building local supply chains makes sense. It can make sense, but there is a tipping point where it doesn't make sense economically. And Charles is probably better placed than I to talk about where is that moment where, frankly, investing in British supply chains makes less sense than having a global supply chain.
Tobias, according to the Prime Minister, this is the biggest such review since the Second World War. It's already been promised an above inflation increase of 3.4% in the core defence budget. Will the pandemic radically change the emphasis or focus of this review?
I think the pandemic's changed everything. There's no doubt about it. I'd like to believe the Prime Minister when he says that. The evidence to date suggests that we may be going down the route of other reviews, in the sense that it leans more towards the impact of the spending review, so the limits placed on defence budgets, rather than actually our Britain's place in the world. And much as absolutely the industrial strategy is very important and is should reflect aspects of the integrated review, ultimately the fundamental question the review should be asking is, what is the purpose of Britain internationally? How do we defend ourselves? What role do we see us play on the international stage? I fear that we've taken a step back. We've retreated a little bit, potentially because of Brexit, but also I touched on the West itself becoming more risk averse. We've retreated. I remember that vote in 2013 when we chose not to further engage in Syria. And where we've stepped back, where we've left vacuums, other countries have chosen to fill. And there is a big choice that we face at the moment. The United States, no leadership we're seeing there at the moment. We'll have to wait to see what happens with the election in November. We've got a resurgent Russia pushing itself, Putin wanting to reinvigorate his superpower status, China ignoring international rules, doing its thing in the South China Sea. some big questions, but also opportunities. The Israel-UAE peace deal, for example, fantastic opportunity to advance our security and prosperity interests there. But we are being shunted out of many of our relationships that historically we pointed to, such as across the Commonwealth, in Africa. We've been shunted out by both Russia and Chinese operations, which means that we're playing second fiddle. So this review is fundamental in providing focus as to where we actually want to go, to which you then say, how do we design our defence posture? And at the moment, what I see from the MOD is actually they're looking to cut capability. The wedge tail is a great example. This is an ISTAR capability that actually helps our F-35s remain in stealth mode. And we're cutting that back from 5 to 3. Well, 3 aircraft isn't enough to have them operate in any theatre, because you won't have the ability to have on a 12-hour air capabilities. So that's an example, I'm afraid, of perhaps where we're whittling down and going back to a spending review focus rather than integrated review.
Charles, Tony, Tobias, thanks for joining me.